Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, the latest WISO Curious answers the question of why the Yellow Springs Farmers Market closes so early. We'll also hear about the rise of microbreweries around the Miami Valley. And later in the program, the golden voice of tenor Martin Bakari. He'll perform later today at the Friends Care Community Center in Yellow Springs. Earlier in the week, he stopped by to talk with our very own Nikki Dakota. Up first, Beaver Creek police say the state will investigate Tuesday night's shooting of a man brandishing a gun inside a Walmart store. Police shot and killed 22-year-old John Crawford of Fairfield after he failed to comply with verbal orders. Chief of Police Dennis Evers says he thinks Beaver Creek police reacted appropriately.
The quick response of officers was instrumental in containing this situation, minimizing the risk to customers.
Evers has asked Attorney General Mike DeWine's office to have state investigators look into the shooting. He says his office will cooperate with that investigation. In 2010, the Dayton Daily News reports one of the officers involved, Sean Williams, fatally shot a man while investigating a domestic violence call in his home. Williams was cleared of any wrongdoing. Beaver Creek police say 37-year-old Angela D. Williams of Fairborn simultaneously suffered a medical emergency Tuesday night while shopping in the Walmart store. She died later at Soyent Medical Center. No one else was hurt. Later in the week, DeWine's office confirmed that Crawford was holding an MK-177 pellet rifle when he was killed by police officers. The pellet gun is described as a tactical variable pump air rifle, useful for both target practice and going after small game. It shoots pellets or BBs at a high velocity, and it is an item that Walmart sells in its stores. Other details of the case are still unclear, but a spokeswoman for the Attorney General's office says their crime unit's investigation into the shooting is likely to take months. A controversial issue in Dayton has come to an end, at least for the moment. The issue of whether or not the city should host immigrant children from Central America in temporary shelters. WISO's Lewis Wallace reports the federal government has now said they won't need Dayton's help after all.
Dayton's Democratic Mayor Nan Whaley had gone head-to-head with Republican Congressman Mike Turner and a group of local Republicans. They opposed the mayor's offer to provide housing for the thousands of unaccompanied kids showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border. Many of them are running from violence in their home countries. But now the Department of Health and Human Services says the number of children crossing the border has gone way down. Mayor Whaley says Dayton should still step in if needed.
The federal government called and asked us to be helpful. If they need our help, we have our role, duty as Americans to be as helpful as we can be.
The federal government is responsible for finding temporary shelter for the children until they can go in front of a judge who decides whether they'll stay or be deported. HHS says it has successfully released tens of thousands of the kids to sponsors inside the U.S. this year, including 360 in Ohio. Meanwhile, Congress has been gridlocked on legislation to address the problem. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
This week, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati heard oral arguments in several same-sex marriage cases in Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Capacity crowds filled the Potter Stewart courtroom in Cincinnati, plus two additional overflow rooms for spectators, and advocates on both sides of the issue held rallies and prayer vigils outside the courthouse. 31 states have had gay marriage bans in place, enacted through both constitutional amendments and state law, but numerous states have seen bans overturned recently by court rulings. Many gay marriage opponents say the issue should be decided by voters. 19 states have legalized same-sex marriage through court decision, legislative efforts, or popular vote. The federal court in Cincinnati heard arguments around six cases from the four states. Arguments focused on the rights of same-sex couples to adopt children, have their names placed on a partner's death certificate, and to have their legal marriages performed elsewhere recognized in their home states. No word on when the judges will issue rulings on the cases, but stakeholders on both sides of the issue say they're likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's been a tough month already for the Democratic candidate for governor, Ed Fitzgerald. His poll numbers and fundraising are still well behind incumbent Republican John Kasich, and now he's had to explain he wasn't doing anything inappropriate with a woman he was found in a car with on a very early morning in October of 2012, and he's had to apologize for driving without a valid license for a decade in the early 2000s. Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler sat down with two campaign veterans to talk about what's next for the Fitzgerald campaign, if anything.
Mark Weaver has been an advisor to Republicans from Ronald Reagan to Mike DeWine to Betty Montgomery, and he still runs candidate and issue campaigns. He says the flap involving the woman and the driver's license are just the latest in a string of problems for the Democratic candidate, and that by this point in the campaign, Fitzgerald has to know it.
In his heart, Ed Fitzgerald's going to give up. He won't suspend his campaign necessarily. He won't stop moving around the state. But everywhere he goes, it'll be, why aren't you raising money? Why aren't your poll numbers better? How come you didn't have a driver's license for 10 years? Even if he's not asked about the woman, he'll get those questions over and over again. In his heart, he'll say, I can't win.
Greg Haas was a key strategist for Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign and has also run other statewide and local races, and he's the former head of the Franklin County Democratic Party. He says the problem isn't the questions about the controversy, it's that there's no strong message that the campaign has that would override them.
I haven't heard or have been able to sort out from the campaign what is the roadmap to victory. And you need to put that in a package so that people understand it and can see it. And if you don't do that, then people are left to focus on all of these kind of tactics or these distractions and things like that. You need to really show the public, particularly the opinion makers, this is how you win this thing.
Fitzgerald also sent out an email to supporters this week saying that a cancer scare with his son, who's in remission, has helped his family learn to focus on what really matters, but that he's not looking for sympathy. Ha says that's exactly what Fitzgerald means, that this health crisis has given him and his family some perspective on the race.
I mean, I think that they were making clear where their priorities were at and their focus was at. They're not trying for sympathy any more than John Kasich being on TV talking about his parents being killed in an auto accident. I mean, is it trying for sympathy when you do things like that?
Weaver says he doesn't know enough about the situation to read into the email.
Sounds like, for whatever reason, Ed Fitzgerald wants to spend more time with his family right now. And he's had a real hard week. And when you've had a real tough week, I want to be with my family, so I don't really understand what happened with that email. I've had several reporters say to me they're not quite sure what it means. It may just mean that he wants to be with his family after a really hard week of some big political problems.
Ohio Democratic Party Chair Chris Redfern says the party was not aware that Fitzgerald did not have a valid driver's license, and that Fitzgerald has apologized profusely and told him that he was a, quote, horrible procrastinator. Fitzgerald does have a license now. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
You can see the full interview with Greg Haas and Mark Weaver on State of the State at statenews.org. Nothing brings consensus like a crisis. During Toledo's recent drinking water ban, conflicting ideas about how to test for toxins caused confusion for decision makers. That problem sparked rare, swift action by multiple layers of government to create a uniform statewide protocol. From Ohio Public Radio, member station WCPN, Joanna Richards reports.
When Toledo's internal water sample testing revealed potentially dangerous levels of microcystin, the city issued the ban on drinking it and notified the state's Environmental Protection Agency. Then the city and the EPA began sending out a series of water samples to five different labs, all with different testing procedures.
Some of the test methods were showing that there was nothing in the water. Some of the test methods were showing that there was a level above the World Health Organization recommended limit for drinking water.
That's Brenda Snyder, chief chemist for Toledo's Water Division. She says city officials made the right decision by erring on the side of public health throughout the crisis. She says testing for microcystin has only recently moved out of the most sophisticated research labs and into those of municipal water systems like Toledo's. Over the past 10 years, testing has gotten better, with results available in hours rather than days. But
the scientific community does not yet have a easy, simple, easily verifiable, robust test.
Snyder says the way water samples are processed, the equipment that's used, and how the operator is trained can all impact results. That poses problems for decision makers in a crisis. In Toledo, they cast the broadest net possible, then went with the most conservative course of action. And during that flurry of activity, the local, state, and federal officials involved, all with different views on which testing methods were best, sat down and hashed out a way forward. That written protocol for how testing would be conducted is now in the hands of every public water system in Ohio.
So that everybody is doing it consistently.
That's Craig Butler, head of Ohio EPA. He says the method everyone ultimately agreed on was the one least likely to give a false negative result, to say toxin levels are lower than they really are. Snyder, the Toledo water chemist who took part in the discussions, says it's the same test that had been showing unsafe levels of toxins when other tests weren't. She says all the current testing methods are imperfect, and as algae blooms become more of a threat to drinking water, there's an urgent need to improve them. Meanwhile, officials who struggled with the testing confusion are pushing the federal government for guidance. There's no national standard on safe levels of microcystin. In Toledo, officials use the World Health Organization's one part per billion recommended maximum. The U.S. EPA has said it will release its own recommended limit late this year or early next year. But state EPA Chief Craig Butler says it's needed sooner.
I've talked to the national administrator of EPA and her senior staff in the last couple of days saying, I know you're working on this, but this is a clear example of why we need to accelerate that research.
Butler says officials now seem to agree on the best methodology for testing for microcystin. Now they need a firm consensus on how much is safe. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Joanna Richards in Cleveland.
Thousands of athletes from around the world arrived in Northeast Ohio this week to compete in the 9th Gay Games. Although this Olympic-styled sporting event focuses on LGBT participants, you don't have to be gay to compete. From Ohio Public Radio member station WCPM, David C. Barnett profiles three Ohio competitors who say they found their true selves through sports.
Rob Smitherman has a passion for basketball. At 6'7", he looks the part, although he's modest about his abilities.
I was a Division III guy. I was no talent and tall.
But he says his lifelong love of basketball was tempered by the fact that as a gay man, he couldn't find a role model in the macho world of sports. In the 1990s, things started to change, especially when the internet came along.
One day, I typed in gay basketball. And all these things came up, and then I found a team, and they were going to the Gay Games.
The Gay Games were established in 1982 by Olympic decathlete Tom Waddell as a means for members of the LGBT community to express their true identities in a large-scale public event at a time when homosexuality was not openly discussed. Smitherman, who is associate executive director of this year's games, says a major goal of the competition is to be a symbol of cultural inclusion.
It is a diverse event, and it is an event that encourages everyone to participate so we can show that everyone is participating regardless of whether they're gay or not, regardless of whether they're good or not.
But he emphasizes that the games won't just be a bunch of amateurs stumbling across area gyms and arenas. Numerous athletes with Division I collegiate experience will compete with each other, while those with lesser skills will play in their own divisions. In all, over 35 sports will be featured in venues across Greater Cleveland and Akron. Beachwood native Lori Rosenberg will be playing first base for her team in the women's softball competition. As a teenager growing up in the 1970s, she felt marginalized as a gay woman, and she says it was sports that gave her a sense of achievement and self-worth, a feeling that she wants to share with others.
What I like about this team is that it is diverse in ethnicity and in age and in background. That truly is the spirit of the games.
Another competitor is preparing for this year's Gay Games at the Power Shack Fitness Center in suburban Columbus. Mason Caminiti says he felt a little out of place when he first started training among the beefy guys building up their biceps.
Still the same worried about like the fat on the upper thigh.
He likes to worry.
Personal trainer Sean Nutter pulls out a pair of calipers to measure the body fat on the 5'4" Caminiti.
I don't care about weight. I care about fat loss and maintaining as much muscle as possible.
It's hard to imagine that there could possibly be an excess ounce of fat on Caminiti's slender body. And it's easy to overlook the faint scars from a mastectomy he had several years ago when he began the transition from the female body he was born with. But before the expensive multiple surgeries and drug therapies, he began his personal change through the sport of bodybuilding.
The big thing with weight training is that it was a way for me to make my body more masculine and transition before I had access to any of that.
Caminiti has never competed in the Gay Games before, and the 38-year-old bodybuilder admits that he's a little nervous about being out as a transgender male in front of thousands of people. But he also sees his training for the event as part of the process of becoming the person he feels like inside.
To really sculpt and change my body to make it exactly the way I've always thought of or dreamed about when I was younger. I mean, it's been amazing. It really has been.
Gay Games official Rob Smitherman knows how that feels and says it can be life-changing.
You march into the opening ceremony for the first time and realize that people are accepting you as you are, and that the first time you feel that is, it's so affirming and so amazing.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm David C. Barnett.
Organizers estimate that some 9,000 athletes from around the world will get to share that feeling. Opening ceremonies for the 2014 Gay Games got underway last night in downtown Cleveland. You might be one of those people who gets up at the crack of dawn on Saturdays to head down to your local farmer's market, or you might not. WISO listener Gabrielle Seville is not. She lives in Yellow Springs, where the farmer's market runs from 7 a.m. to noon, and she has a question about that.
This is why so curious, and my question is why so early? Why is the farmer's market over by noon?
Chances are you've heard her question on our airwaves before. In honor of National Farmers Market Week, Why So Curious is taking the question on. Here's Will Davis.
I'm not a morning person, so without any judgment, I talked to Gabrielle Seville, and she was slightly embarrassed by the notoriety of her question.
You know, if I had known that that would have been one of the sound bites that would be circulating in the Miami Valley, I probably would have come up with, why don't we have world peace, or, you know.
Well, I'll tackle world peace after my morning coffee, but I asked Gabrielle, why does she even care about farmers markets?
Because I've heard these legendary stories about the Yellow Springs farmers market, that if you get there at 7 a.m., there are throngs of people, people you never see at any other time, who are standing in line for croissants that are small batched in from Cincinnati, or all these things. They're these legendary things, and I guess if I were willing to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning, I could find out, but Friday night is, you know, a night to be out.
Thank God it's...
So I've lived in Yellow Springs for 20 years, and I've never been to the farmer's market. It happens way too early for me. But I had a job to do, so I set my alarm for 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning. The Yellow Springs farmer's market is downtown in the parking lot of a shopping area called King's Yard. It's just after sunrise when I get there. People are lined up at several tents, including Blue Oven Bakery. These are the croissants that Gabrielle was talking about. Baker Charles Hansen says he sells at lots of markets, and this one is different.
This farmer's market is the earliest we do, and personally, I spend the night at the bakery just to do it.
But he says it's worth the trouble. He always sells out.
I probably bought 250 loaves of bread, 150 croissants, and 350 muffins today, and 4 hours go by, and boom, gone. It's crazy. And trust me, there's a nap involved in my day after this.
So is Yellow Springs unusual? Well, the Troy and Trotwood farmers markets are both from 9 to 2. In Springfield, the Saturday market is from 9 to 12:30. Turns out there's really no agreement on the best time for a farmers market.
Well, I would say the majority right now are Saturday mornings.
That's Christy Welsh. She's the farmers market specialist at Ohio State. She says you have to think about lots of things when scheduling a farmer's market.
It really depends on the location and what's going to be most beneficial for the consumers and the producers.
The location. That's what market organizer Michelle Burns says is the reason why the Yellow Springs farmer's market closes so early. Burns reminds me it's in a parking lot that belongs to a group of local shops.
Because they were running the King's Yard businesses, they wanted the vendors to be gone by the time that area really started picking up during the day. So most of those shops open 11 or 12 and we're out of there by then.
Step aside, farmers. Make way for fair trade crafts. Burns has heard complaints, but 7 to noon is just fine for plenty of folks. Like regulars Deborah Oswald and Karen Kimber, by 8 a.m., they're already leaving the market with almost everything they wanted.
I don't think it's too early. I like to get up early and come to market, and then you get on with the rest of your day.
And you do have to get here early because today we didn't even get greens because the greens were gone.
So, Gabrielle, we snooze, we lose. But hey, the next time I'm up that early, I'll pick you up one of those small batch croissants.
Ooh, thanks.
For WYSO, I'm Will Davis.
Why So Curious is our series that answers your questions about the Miami Valley's history, people, or economy. Tell us what you're curious about today at WYSO.org. This week in our Community Voices radio series, we bring you beer, local beer. Jason Reynolds has been wondering about the boom in local beer making. Here's his report on the Miami Valley micro brewing boom and how it's helping Dayton to recover from the recent economic recession.
Can I have a Captain Stardust and a wobbly wheel?
That's the sound of drinks being ordered at the Yellow Springs Brewery, just outside of Dayton, Ohio. It's a scene that's become common as microbreweries pop up across the Miami Valley. And that's the sound of money being made. It's become more common, too. Craft and microbrewing have become cottage industries in Ohio, putting $1.3 billion into the state economy last year. And Dayton is perhaps the best example of how the microbrewing movement can help small cities. In January of 2011, there were no small breweries in Dayton. Today, there are 10 operating, and 3 more slated to open this year. But why Dayton? And why now?
What it is, I think, that's special about Dayton is everyone that I'm talking to is really thinking locally and regionally about a lot of things, and beer in particular.
That's Brian Hoosh. He's part owner of the Brew News, a weekly publication dedicated to beer drinking in Dayton. In addition to the Think Local, Drink Local movement, he believes that craft beer is the next natural step for the American palate.
It's kind of following trends like what we've seen with wine or with coffee. And I think it's kind of logical that beer kind of came in that progression. We had wine and people started to develop their tastes. Coffee, people are very sophisticated. And now the craft brew thing.
I visited the Yellow Springs Brewery on a Sunday afternoon, and there was a line stretching from the bar to the door. Once inside, I spoke to Jen Erickson and Nick Budis about the brewery and why they became regulars.
I mean, the art, everything about it, the atmosphere, the location, right off the bike path, it's just really, it's a welcome addition to the neighborhood.
There's something to be said also for the fact that this is a locally made product. When you come here, not only are you having fun with a group of people that are enjoying themselves, but the idea that this is something that was made right here in Yellow Springs and Greene County, the Dayton area.
But it's not just consumers who are supporting local breweries. It's the state government, too. In 2011, Ohio microbreweries that operated tap rooms had to pay $8,000 in licensing fees, and they weren't allowed to distribute their own products. Today, the same licensing costs only $1,000, and small breweries can sell directly to bars and restaurants, effectively cutting out the middleman and maximizing profits. These incentives are important, both to small brewers and to the city. Phil Height has been working with Bonbright Beer Distributors for 7 years now, and he sees Dayton's beer boom sparking new pride in the city's neighborhoods.
For so long, things have just been leaving. It's been an exodus of jobs and companies and everybody from, God, MCR to General Motors to Delphi and, God, everybody else. Well, now it seems, hey, these people thought enough to actually start a business here with us. And they've created a lot of good buzz because they make good beer. They run their businesses in a socially responsible way, in a locally and environmentally responsible way. It makes it real visible and people can see it instantly and it connects. Because how long has it been since somebody said, hey, Dayton, Ohio rocks. I want to be part of Dayton, Ohio. We want to start a business right here in Dayton for Dayton.
And that pride extends from brewery to brewery. Dayton tap rooms often stock their competitors' beer, and there's even talk of collaborative brewing. I spoke to Lisa Walters and Nate Cornett, owners of the Yellow Springs Brewery, and Walters noted that the beer community is shockingly friendly, which leads to some interesting business decisions.
I'm actually seeing a lot of bars / restaurants, they're creating these tours to take people out of their own bars and restaurants, but coming to the breweries to educate their customers. I mean, it's kind of slightly risky in a way, I guess. They're taking their customers to other places, but in turn, they are getting information and they're having a great time.
How long can the number of breweries grow exponentially before the market gets crowded and friends turn to foes? That day may be coming, but no time soon. Nate Cornett of the Yellow Springs Brewery told WYSO about how busy he's been.
We expanded. We ran out of beer after our first 6 weeks being open, so we had to expand. We doubled our capacity then, and we're about to double our capacity hopefully in the next couple weeks. So it's a hungry beast that has to be fed, and so you just keep trying to keep up with demand.
And that demand is almost unrealistically high at the moment. When Cornett says he ran out of beer, he means that literally. The brewery had to close and catch up. The Yellow Springs Brewery invited me to their first anniversary. But to my surprise, Walters noted that they haven't publicized their birthday party. They're afraid they may run out of beer. Again. If you're looking to drink beer or to open a brewery, now is the time, and Dayton may be the place. For Community Voices, this is Jason Reynolds.
Support for Community Voices is provided by the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation. For more Community Voices stories and information on our training program, visit wyso.org. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us.
What land of silence, where pain...
Vocalist Martin Beccari is a 2005 graduate of Yellow Springs High School, now living in New York. Growing up, he performed in the YS Kids Playhouse and Friends Music Camp. Beccari will perform this afternoon at 2 p.m. at Friends Care Community Center in Yellow Springs. Earlier this week, he stopped in to talk with Nikki Dakota on Excursions and talk about those early experiences with the arts and his upcoming performance.
Silent valley that we will find, where all the voices of humankind.
That's the Memorex version of a live performance, but we can do that up even one more. It's a pleasure to welcome to the studio that tenor voice and Yellow Springs native. He's Mr. Martin Beccari. Martin, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
You were born and raised in this fair burg.
Well, I was actually born in Seattle, Washington, but I moved here when I was 2 years old.
Oh.
And I lived here until I was 18 and graduated from Yellow Springs High School and went off to college. So this is very much home for me, yes.
Very much. And you came through sort of all this amazing richness of art instruction that is available in the Miami Valley and the region. And one of your first performances was in the first performance of the Yellow Springs Kids Playhouse.
Absolutely, yes. The first performing experience I ever had, actually, was when I was 6 years old. I did the very first YS Kids Playhouse show, which was Dick Tracy the musical, and I was, once again, I was 6 years old, and then I did the next six shows, so I did the first seven YS Kids Playhouse shows. I did it clear up until I was, I guess, 12 years old, and those were incredibly formative and important experiences for me. I'm fairly certain that I would not be doing what I am today if it weren't for John Fleming asking my mom at the Children's Center, where he was picking up one of his children, if I might want to come down and audition for this show he was directing, which was the very first YS Kids Playhouse show. And none of us knew what was going on, but we said, hey, why not? We're free Saturday morning, and the rest was history.
So lovely. You're back in town, sort of giving back in another way. You'll be performing this Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes.
At the Friends Care Center here in Yellow Springs.
Right.
And Friends also is the sort of the term that Quakers refer to themselves
exactly
with, the
right.
Friends Care Center, which reminds us that you also came up, in addition to YSKP, attending the Friends Music Camp,
exactly,
which is over
yes.
at the Olney School.
Right, yeah. I was there for three summers when I was 11, 12, and 13 years old. And they were three incredibly important summers, not only in my musical development, but in my personal development. It was my first time being away from home.
Oh.
That's
big, yeah.
Exactly. My first summer, I was originally only signed up to be there for 2 weeks. But I loved it so much that I begged my parents to let me stay for 4 weeks. And luckily, they said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back the next 2 years. And then I actually played football in high school. And it was difficult for me to take a month away from preseason training. So I unfortunately had to stop going. But I always had dreams of coming back in some capacity, whether it was as a dorm counselor or as a teacher. I didn't know I would pursue music as a career, so I just wanted to come back in some capacity. And about 13 years later, someone reached out and said they had an opening for a voice teacher. And I thought, well, you know, it'd be nice if my schedule would allow it. And I looked at my schedule, and somehow it just so happened that I had 4 weeks free right in the middle of the summer. And so I went back and I did it, and I had such a wonderful time that I crossed my fingers and hoped that the stars would align again for me to return the following summer, which was this summer. And I did, and it was a spectacular and wonderful and memorable month. I really, really hope that I can go back next summer as well, because it's really one of those things. It's funny, you know, people often ask me or just say, oh, it's so great that you're giving back, you know, and yeah, I guess you could look at it that way, but there's really nowhere else I'd rather be than Friends Music Camp.
You actually
for that
love
month.
It.
Exactly. It's something that, that is healing, and it's a beautiful sort of musical getaway in my very sort of hectic and somewhat stressful New York City life. So
we're going to talk about how you got to New York, but I'll remind everyone that your name is Martin Bakari, and
yes.
We're claiming you as a local boy done good.
Oh, yes, please.
We're claiming full rights. He's at the Friends Care Center here in Yellow Springs this Sunday at 2 p.m. Tickets will be available at the door, and the piece that we heard will be among the pieces that you perform. We've got another one here. Can you tell us, I was going to play
I Would Not Alter Thy Cold Eyes.
Tell us a little bit about the composer who's also in town, and then I want to hear a little bit of this too.
Okay, yeah, let me tell you a little bit about the piece itself. The piece is called Dowson Songs. A friend of mine named Grigory Smirnov, who I met while we were both fellows at the Tanglewood Music Festival, and who's also a Juilliard alum, he and I were together for this summer. We got to know each other and got to know each other's work very well and took a liking to one another personally and musically. And he received a big commission from the ASCAP Foundation to write a song cycle. And so he asked me if he could write it for me. And of course I said, yes, sure. And so he wrote it. And I premiered it in New York City at Merkin Hall back in April. So I thought while I was in town visiting my family, I would let the lovely people of Yellow Springs hear it.
I would not alter thy cold eyes, nor trouble the calm fount of speech with aught of passion or surprise. The heart of thee I cannot reach. I would not alter thy cold eyes.
So I'm going to be doing that on Sunday at 2 o'clock at Friends Care Center. But the piece itself, it's about 45 minutes in length. And they are settings of poems by the English Romantic poet Ernest Dowson. Ernest Dowson was a good friend of Oscar Wilde and William Butler Yeats. And though he was not as well known as his colleagues, his writings were said to have influenced theirs very much. He was lived quite a troubled life. He at the age of 23... fell in love with a woman who he ultimately could not have. And it messed this guy up pretty bad. He ended up drinking himself to an early and penniless death at the age of 32. And so much of his work is influenced by this experience, and much of his poetry is very heavy and sorrowful. But Grigory wanted to provide a sort of resolution to Dowson's drama through music, and that's what he's done. He's set 10 poems to music, and there's an interlude and a postlude that's played by piano. This piece is for tenor and piano. I think that he does a pretty wonderful job of wrapping things up in a less tragic way.
You have a website. Where could people find out a little bit more what you have going on?
Well, they could Google me, just Martin Bakari, my name, MartinBakari, or they could go to my website, which is www.martinbakari.com.
Pretty straightforward. You could come to the show and listen a little bit more this Sunday at 2 p.m. But you make your home in New York City now. How did you make this beautiful globe and land in the prime American metropolis?
Well, as you know, I grew up in Yellow Springs. I went to Boston University for my undergraduate, and I stuck around an extra couple years for this program called the Opera Institute, which is a sort of artist diploma program. And then I wanted to get my master's degree, and the good people at Juilliard were kind enough to take me in. And so I spent 2 years there getting a master's degree, and that was about a year ago that I graduated, and I've been there ever since.
Nice. Well, congratulations on your great good fortune, and to be, I always count myself so lucky to do something that I love. You clearly have that relationship
Absolutely.
With your work.
Absolutely.
Do you wake up singing?
No. I wake up often listening to music. But But, you know, it's one of those things where oftentimes we ask a lot of our voices. So I try to conserve for when it is that I really, really need to use it.
MartinBakari.com is a place to keep some tabs on this amazing young voice and talent, and this local boy done well indeed. That's Martin Bakari, spelled MartinBakari.com. Or you could go to the Friends Care Center this Sunday at 2 p.m.
I should say, I would be remiss not to mention the phenomenal pianist who I'll be performing with on Sunday. This is Sam Reich, another local musician, fine player.
Here he is, Martin Bakari. Thank you for coming by and sharing a little bit of your beautiful... You have a light. I like the light that you emit. It's nice.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. Hopefully they can catch that on the radio waves. I don't know how that works, really.
You can. I think you really can. It's weird. Radio is magical beyond its radio wavelength. Martin Bakari, that's Martin, BAKARI.com for more information. Thank you again, Martin.
Thank you.
As rain upon the town.
Tenor Martin Bakari performs later today at 2 p.m. at Friends Care Community Center in Yellow Springs. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next week. Coming up next, The Book Nook.